Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you are listening to Maltin on Movies. And today we have someone who is primarily known not for movies, but for his incredible and prolific output on television, Mr. Chuck Lorre. And welcome, Chuck.
Thank you.
Mr. Prolific Output. That's exactly. It's funny. It said that on
the business card.
On the building
I'm sure
outside.
It says that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Prolific Output.
Oh, great.
Hello,
to
Mr.
To be known
Prolific.
For quantity. That's terrific.
But I mean, we're sitting here at Warner Brothers with you, and you've got just a few of the shows you've worked on around us, and they're all really good, and people really love them. And that's saying something. They also play around the world. My husband is from England, and mm-hmm. when I'm there, two shows play on repeat, several, but two in particular, and it's Two and a Half Men and Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter where I am, you follow me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. No, but it's an incredible thing to think that it's not just, you know, we're here in LA, mm-hmm. and so a lot of things, feels like everybody does this. You're surrounded by talented and creative people, but then you go around the world and you realize just what the reach is.
The pervasiveness of this medium is astonishing.
It is.
You know, I recently had a couple of weeks off and I went to Africa.
Wow.
And people know the stuff.
They
people
sure
in
do.
Kenya, they know this. They know Young Sheldon, the new show. And you know what struck me even more so was that. In like Kenya and South Africa, there are many languages spoken, and they have a choice when they're starting school as to what language to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help but thinking that all the television that and movies that we export influence the choice of language.
Of course it does.
I mean, and music, and I mean, if you want to understand what Beyonce's singing about, you pick English.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's becoming the language that... that is becoming a planetary language is a largely to do with entertainment.
Mm.
Well, amazing.
I was in Israel.
I sort of,
do you remember?
I'm just enough of a old-fashioned purist to bemoan the loss of the U in color in England. You know,
the U in the spelling of color.
Color, yes, yes. Civilization with an S instead of a Z.
Uh-huh.
I like those differences. I like regionalism.
Yeah, but the satellites are changing that.
Everything.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know.
That's what, do you remember when I went to Israel? I did Birthright. I went to Israel and did Birthright.
Uh-huh.
And all they do is quote Big Bang and How I Met Your Mother. All of them.
Uh-huh.
It's the strangest thing to be with members of the IDF, the military in Israel,
uh-huh.
and all they do is quote those two shows. It was surreal. And
wow.
that's your bait, you know, that's yours. And they all know your vanity cards at the end. That's the other thing that amazes me, is that something that I think if you pitched that on its own, people would say, oh, I don't know. But now it's almost like a collector's item that they go, no, I've read every single one. I
That's
know all
crazy.
Of them back and forth.
Wow.
You're like baseball cards, but television.
but worthless.
Hardly worthless. Hardly worthless. You get to do neat stuff.
Were you a TV junkie growing up?
Probably just as much as any other kid growing up in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was Get Smart, you know, and Lucy and the Honeymooners, and then later in the 60s... you know, the Smothers Brothers and Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when the Smothers Brothers and Star Trek were, I believe they were canceled on the same year, I swore off television.
Mm.
I wanted nothing to do with a medium that would lose the two best shows on television. So I really did. I didn't have a TV for most of the 70s. Unless I was romantically involved with a woman who owned a TV, I didn't have one.
That is a good thing to look for in a partner, though. That's a solid thing on your list of, so do you have cable?
Do you have Trinitron and a roof would be when you're struggling.
I like it, though.
That's big time.
It's a good way to go.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
Long Island.
Long Island.
Mm. Now, how can we possibly convey to anybody of a younger set the Honeymooners and the constancy of the Honeymooners? There were only 39 episodes, mm-hmm. and we ran them over and over and over again, and I didn't mind one bit because I would watch them over and over and over again.
It was the characters.
Yeah.
Mm. It was the character. The characters were more important than the stories. The relationships were more important than the stories. The characters were iconic and brilliantly played.
Yeah.
The best buddy comedy in the world with Norton, you know, and Ralph. And it was, I didn't know I was getting an education, but I was getting an education watching those
guys. Yeah, we all were to one degree.
And Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
Even the Stooges. I mean, you were getting you were learning about vaudeville.
Yeah.
And you didn't know it. You're just happy that.
The roots of American comedy.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And who knows? I mean, it's in there, right? It's in your consciousness. It's in mine. Mm-hmm. Not so much Jesse's.
Oh, you beat it into me, man. I think it's there.
I was fortunate because, in the ways that you don't realize you're fortunate at the time, but. You know, we had the little black and white TV, and on Sunday nights was The Wonderful World of Disney and Ed Sullivan. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you know, I'm 13, 14, younger, 12, 11 years old. I want to watch Disney, you know. My dad had Sunday nights off. That was his night off. Mm-hmm. We watched Sullivan, and I got to see every great stand-up of that era.
Yeah.
And that was an education.
Including forgotten figures like Myron Cohen.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shecky Green.
Yeah.
and then you get to meet, you know, Stiller and Mira,
of course.
And just endless, all the guys that worked the Borscht Belt and had perfected and mastered the craft of making an audience laugh.
And yet what I found fascinating about the Sullivan Show, which made it different from the West Coast show, The Hollywood Palace, is that on the Sullivan Show, people would die. you'd watch comics come out and die. Mm-hmm. The audience was not responding. That was really live TV.
Mm-hmm. Now, in watching Ed Sullivan, when it wasn't, for me growing up watching it, obviously it was a long time ago, did you understand Ed Sullivan? Because all I felt growing up watching it with my family was, why this guy?
Why is a brick in charge of
this
show? Why is a cement brick running the show?
Like everyone came through. Yeah. But I remember my dad showing it to me, and I just kind of looked at him and went, really, this guy?
It speaks to the power of the written word. He was a journalist.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that as a kid.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that he was an influential journalist.
Yeah.
That they'd given a TV show to.
Journalist is perhaps too highfalutin a word to use for Ed, but he was a columnist.
Columnist, yeah. Okay, but he was widely read
and influential.
At a time when, the power of the written word was really something. So I had no understanding of that at all.
Nor did I.
Yeah, he was just the worst person in the world in front of a camera. And at a time, and it became a bit.
It became a bit.
Comics did him.
Yeah.
And he loved it. He understood that he'd become a shtick.
Yeah.
And it became its own thing. He kind of looked forward to it.
He was smart enough not to fight it, but to embrace it.
Yes. Oh, he absolutely was. And I didn't understand any of that at the time. I just knew that you were going to get, opera singers, jugglers, comics.
Yeah.
And
Senor Wences.
And Senor Wences.
We love Senor Wences.
God bless him. I got to meet Senor Wences.
You did?
Ah, one of the thrills of my life.
Wow.
I have a picture of me and Wences and the man in the box, Pedro.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, my beard was dark.
Thought I.
And his wife said, I look just like Pedro.
And he does. And the photo is priceless because he's got it open. Wow. And you're like, hello, boys.
That was a magical moment.
The first time I started doing this to my dad, he actually looked at me and said, I'm just so proud. Just, hello. Too white. Yes. These are the small victories.
Mesmerizing television.
So good.
Yeah. It sure was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And like you, I kind of got disaffected or disenchanted.
Mm-hmm.
TV around the time I went to college. It's like a lot of the shows that I relied on and counted on were were, you know, passing on, you know, mm-hmm. being replaced by a new generation of shows, some of which I later came to appreciate, but no, I kind of was off TV for a while.
You know, guys were marrying witches, genies, or and not having sex with a genie, which was, as a young man, was very upsetting to me, who said, anything I can do to please you, master, and he'd go, leave me alone. And I'd be sitting there going, oh, this is nonsense. You're lying to me. Television is lying to me.
Perhaps puberty reached you sooner than it did me.
But thankfully, but Norman Lear changed everything.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Norman Lear changed everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. I was saying to Jesse that when I was growing up, I devoured TV Guide every week. Yeah. Just mm-hmm. couldn't. I had to inspect every page, see what was on. And a description of an episode of a comedy would be, Beaver forgets his lunchbox at home.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Mm-hmm.
There was no B story, C story, D story.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Well, did he get his lunchbox back?
Maybe he did. I don't remember.
Wow.
I confess, I don't remember.
That's simple and you
but
forgot.
But in a show like that, he probably did.
He probably did. That's yeah. fair.
There was a life lesson in there somewhere.
He probably had 27, 28 minutes to get it.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. What is it down to now? 22?
It's under. A little bit less, I think, right?
21:30.
21:30. Ouch.
Yeah, it's haiku.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why these shows, the streaming shows, that's why you binge them so quickly. Is
they're commercials.
Not very long.
Yeah. I'm going through the I'm right now in the middle of year three of Breaking Bad, for watching it now for the third time.
Oh,
and
my.
It's spectacular, but you realize the episodes are 40 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, but every episode is a gem. It's just spectacular writing and work. It's just, it's breath. I just can't. I know what's coming. I've seen them. I've watched them. I've studied them. And it's just like a great song. It just holds up over and over again. It's remarkable.
Well, speaking of music, though, you're a music guy.
I started with that, yeah. That was the dream.
That's a pretty cool dream, and you wrote a song that was a hit.
Well, I think that's overstating it. It did okay. It promised possibly that there might be a career in that, the Debbie Harry thing.
Yeah,
you're talking about? Yeah.
But that's no small feat, it's Debbie Harry.
Yeah. That was, you know, and you have to, from my perspective, that happened after I'd written about 400 shitty songs. Right? And that's not an inflated number. I was determined to try and master that craft. I never really became particularly adept at it. Not when I measure it against great songwriters. I was very primitive and limited. In my abilities, but it was thrilling when it happened.
Of course it was.
It's on the radio, and oh my God, I thought I died and gone to heaven. And I actually got to meet Debbie Harry a couple of years ago for the first time, and profusely say thank you. I had never met her. It just kind of all happened through intermediaries, and I'd never gotten to say thanks.
Wow.
It was really something.
It's nice you had that ability.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you transition from that into writing?
Of starving to death.
That'll do it.
a time-old motivation.
Yes, and I had two young children, and it's interesting. There was a moment in the 80s when the Debbie Harry song, French Kissin', came out, and it looked like, oh my God, this could actually be what I've been trying to do for whatever 15 years, trying to make it in that business. And I'd gotten the door cracked open a little bit to writing for television, children's animation. And I made a decision that I was not necessarily giving up music, but I was definitely not going to risk their protein needs by staying in music, and I went, you know, full force into trying to make it in television, because I just felt that was, I could count on it, and it had something. I wasn't even close to it at the time yet, but I knew that Writers Guild deal with health insurance could save our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, health insurance played a factor in why I aimed a television. I every time, you know, if your child gets an earache and it bankrupts you, health insurance sounds really good. And so there was health insurance. There was that crazy thing called residuals. Mm-hmm.
Residuals.
Which meant that if they played the thing you wrote again, they sent you money. That's crazy. It's just it's amazing. It was like, are you kidding me? and the checks are good. They don't bounce. You don't have to go into the back of the bar with the nightclub owner and beg him to pay you, which is what happens in music. You know, didn't have much of a show tonight. I'm not paying you guys. What do you mean you're not paying us? I'm not paying you. Get your amps and your guitars and get out. I mean, getting paid with real money was something to be pursued, and television promised that.
And delivered.
And delivered, and provided security for raising children, and that had a lot to do with my choice. I mean, the grandeur and the wonder and the magnificence of the music that we grew up with, you can't compare that with, you know, I Dream of Jeannie. You can't. Not to disregard or dismiss that stuff, but, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, the White Album, my mother-in-law, The Car, not the same means of expression. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't help but be swept up, at least I couldn't help but be swept up in what was happening musically in the 60s and into the 70s.
Sure.
You know?
But when did you find that you had a facility for writing comedy scripts, whether for animation
I started writing in the 70s, trying to write songs that I hoped would lift me out of poverty and provide me with a means of doing something I really loved. And I was, my biggest inspiration for songwriting at the time was Randy Newman.
Mm-hmm. And good choice.
It was a great choice, but not a great commercial choice.
No.
But I loved that he told stories. I really loved that his songs told stories and gave you time, place, form, and event. He gave you a perspective. He would tell you a story from an abhorrent perspective and make it, you know, and bring it to life. He would change his point of view. He wasn't singing from necessarily the protagonist's point of view all the time. Sometimes he was the antagonist, you know. I was mesmerized by that, and I wanted to do that. And so the songwriting that I was doing in the 70s, primitive though it was, and I was certainly not the musician he was, or the composer he was, that was really influenced by that. And so that kind of was a natural transition to then writing a story without a hook, without, you know, two verses, chorus, bridge, solo, chorus, chorus out. You know, storytelling kind of came from that, I think. Huh.
What interesting route. Interesting path.
Circuitous,
but ultimately successful.
You know, I was actually talking to a really extraordinary guitar player recently about whether you succeed or not, musical training changes the way you hear things. Hmm. It doesn't really matter if you've had any success or not. It just changes your ear. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear syncopation, you hear... You know, pianissimo, fortissimo, you hear the rests. Mm-hmm. The rests are, you know, the rests, the pauses are critical. In comedy, the space can make the difference between whether a joke works or not.
Right. So you're saying that essentially a lot of comedy, which is not an original thought of mine, but a lot of comedy is about rhythm.
It's musical, very musical. And when you hear it, you know it. I mean, you instinctively hear it. There's, you know, the language flows.
It's beats,
and it's when it's not there, whether you're conscious of it or not, you probably, there's probably some resistance to what's happening if that rhythm is missing.
I'm sure. Now, when you're at a taping session and you've got a live audience there, mm-hmm. and you've got your cameras set up and your expert actors are, you know, working the script, are you pacing back and forth listening for those beats and mm-hmm. that rhythm?
Yeah, but what's great when you're talking about expert actors, you know, of which I've been fortunate enough to work with a lot, they will often hear a different melody. Mm. They will hear a different, rhythmic, breakdown of a line, and it's not what I heard. Mm. It's better, and that's, you know, it took me a long time to shut up and and allow for other guys in the band to play. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Just back off and see, okay, there's other ways to play this melody, mm-hmm. and that's actually fun. As I've gotten, you know, been doing this a long time now.
So that's a little gift for you then.
Oh, it still says written by Chuck Lorre, but they made it better. So, you know what I mean? The extraordinary actors have their own, you know, their own tempo, their own way of carving up a line, and it's fun to be wrong. Actually, mm-hmm. and say, okay, there's another way to play this song. Great, of course there is. Mm-hmm. Of course there's another way to play this song, but when you're young and scared, there's only one way to play it, and you can be a bit prickly.
And were you?
Oh, yeah, I was terrified. I was terrified because failure meant going back to play the Big Daddy's Lounge in Long Beach. I didn't want to do that. So, every line of every scene of every episode had to work because the alternative was no health care.
John Gregory Dunn wrote this book. It's a very compact book, and it's about he and his wife, Joan Didion, mm-hmm. writing this movie and being the first on the team to write the movie and then being taken off the picture mm-hmm. and being rehired later to do rewrites. And he knows he has impending heart surgery that has to be performed. Not tomorrow, not urgently, but soon. Mm-hmm. So the whole book is about healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole book is about the need for healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that's how he made his decisions and determinations. Mm-hmm. And obviously he's a good writer, but there are realities in life.
Yeah. Yeah. And They're not necessarily romantic realities.
No. But interesting, just the same. Mm-hmm. Now you've had to come up against how do I put the word, egos.
Okay.
There are egos in any business, sure. in every business. Mm-hmm. It's just that in show business, there's more of a magnifying glass, and you know it gets gossiped about more, I guess. How did you deal with that when that first hit you in the face?
That's a very, very complicated question. I was not a kid when I got started in television. I was, going into my pushing 40. And I knew enough to know that you had to create an environment where the star of the show was happy. Mm-hmm. You had to. It was not your show. No, you know, I mean, the word fungible comes to mind when I think of writers on shows, on television shows. The audience wasn't coming to see you. They were coming to see that person. Mm-hmm. And that person's peace of mind and happiness was paramount. Had to happen. So, I remember just trying desperately to tread water and do whatever it took to make that person, whoever that person might be, happy with the process. Because again, I needed to stay indoors. I needed to work. It wasn't a lighthearted exercise working in television.
Yeah.
It was life and death for raising children.
So you had to find some balance, I assume, between still finding a way to satisfy yourself and cater to the star.
Sure.
Because
that's just common sense. It's their show.
Sure.
Even if you created it, it's their show. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the nature of it. And to think otherwise would be, it's insane to think otherwise.
That's also very wise. That's a wise way of looking at things.
I don't think I would look back and say I was wise. It was pretty clear, you know, I wasn't being asked to go sit next to Jay Leno and talk to him. I didn't have a megaphone, you know, to the media. I was we were anonymous.
Yeah, but you should still give yourself some credit.
But anonymity was preferred. It was just the nature of things. Writing and television was an anonymous gig, you know, until it wasn't. and then I don't necessarily know that that's, you know, that's a step forward. But at a certain point, anonymity went away.
When did the shift happen for you?
With Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
I went from just a guy writing television shows and happy to do so, you know, to where I was suddenly a topic of conversation. So, okay, that happened.
But you had already survived Roseanne.
Mm-hmm.
And Brett Butler and some other people, you know, who were either difficult or, you know, problematic, maybe the word is.
I'm going to go was with that particular.
I forget the name of a great writer. He wrote a book, Creative Differences was the name of the book. And he had a great line in it. He said, was it with Rhoda, maybe? I'm trying to remember what star he was writing for. I'd love to take credit for this, but boy, it wasn't mine. He said, we had creative differences. She thought she was creative. I thought differently. and if you stick your head in, but if you put your fists up and try and make that a point of contention, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. It's a no-win situation.
Yeah.
There's not a TV executive or a network executive anywhere in this business, certainly not in the years I've been around, who picks the writer over the star, over the story or the joke. They're not, first of all, viscerally connected to the material,
mm-hmm.
where if you sit in a room for 10, 15 hours a day writing, you become viscerally connected to the material, and you're going to want to defend it. As any writer does with their work, it's built into writing that you then defend the work, because you know you bled for it to some extent, but to do so is a long history of writers being shot out of a cannon because they quite naturally became emotionally connected to what they did because they cared about what they did.
Right.
Because they weren't writing as an exercise in economics. They were writing because they believed in what they were writing.
Yeah.
You know.
Fred Allen used to say, where were you when the page was blank?
Yeah. Absolutely. That is a horrific, horrific thing to stare at a blank page and know that there's 150 people waiting for it to be filled with words. Mm-hmm. And you want them to be good. I mean, I always viewed television as... Are you kidding me? You're going to give me an opportunity to speak to millions of people? How could you not want to use every second of that time as best you can? Yeah. I mean, it's what an opportunity, especially if somebody came up in music wanting to communicate through music. Here is another means to communicate, and it'd be a shame to waste it.
Yeah,
I don't care if there's commercials, and I don't care if there's censorship, and if it's constrained, if it's 21 minutes or doesn't matter. It's still a great opportunity, and you wouldn't want to blow a second of it. So you become kind of manic, or I did, about trying to make every moment of it work, which has served me well. But at the same time, you know, it causes colitis.
Yeah. Which leads me to ask you about your vanity, so-called vanity cards. Mm-hmm. It's another way of expressing yourself, mm-hmm. And it's all you.
But it's and it's free. I don't get paid to do it. I don't charge it. It became an opportunity. It didn't start out that way. It just became, at some point I went, wow, I have another means of communicating. Mm. And I can do whatever I want within the constraints of network television. They would bounce the occasional card they found objectionable. I could, on CBS, I could make fun of Rupert Murdoch, but not Sumner Redstone. Imagine that, right? Occasionally they would get bounced back. But I had not written prose. I'd only written scripts and my hundreds of failed songs. So it was an opportunity to write, put sentences together and make a paragraph and make the paragraph mean something or not.
No, but it was a wonderful, it was a golden opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was mostly ignored till DVD players came along, mm-hmm. because to pause on it with a VHS, because I started it in 96 on Darma and Greg, to pause on the card in 96 with a VHS player, it was very, very hard to do.
Yeah.
It would vibrate.
Yeah.
The letters would wobble. You couldn't read it. You needed a really good tape player to pause and read it. And so nobody paid any attention to it. It was an oddity, a curiosity. And then when you could pause perfectly in the digital era, suddenly it became a problem.
Well, see, what my mom and I would do is she would have me stand really close to the television. Mm-hmm. Just so, because we knew it was coming. And she would just say, just read it out loud as fast as possible. And that's how we did it.
You wouldn't pause.
Before we had pause.
Okay.
Before pause was an option.
Wow.
Was send your child as close to the television as possible. Wow. Have them read it real fast. And I could usually, depending on how long they were, sometimes you'd only get halfway through. Sometimes you could, if you had shorter ones, you could get the whole thing. And then pausing became an option.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said to my mom, now it's your turn to walk over to the TV and read the damn thing yourself. But which we still do,
and then you even gave the world a coffee table book,
mm-hmm.
to solidify this
nonsense
body of work.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Well, again, your choice, your option to do it, and it's a good thing you did.
It was fun. It was
coffee
just
tables everywhere.
A lot of fun. You. It was. It had been suggested by several people over the years, and. Yeah, we finally did it, and I have no idea. I don't even remember why I decided. I know, actually, I do. I didn't think the cards themselves had that much value, so I thought if we can add artwork underneath each one, even if it was just marginal, interesting visual elements, mm-hmm. it maybe the book would have some value. So the words, I didn't have that much faith in the words. Mm.
Well, it's there to be had, as reruns will testify. I want to ask you about something I know you understand, or I think you understand. Why do you think so much comedy derives from anger?
It's an interesting question. I think anger is the first place. I've been sitting in rooms with great comedy writers for, 30 years. And anger is maybe the first place you go. It is the default place you go for comedy. And I think second stop is stupid. In other words, having a stupid character, or mm-hmm. to point to someone's stupidity, is an easy place to go, the better. But you have to go through all those stages to get to the maybe better, richer vein of comedy, which might be from the affection two people have for one another, and their attempts with poor tools to have a relationship. You don't start there. At least I certainly didn't. I think most comedy writers go through stages of work where, it starts with mean and I think mean more than meant than angry. Uh-huh. You know, the put down humor, right? And it's whether you're somebody, you know, at the Harvard Lampoon, or some guy who's found that he can make his friends laugh, and decides to start writing it down. The first place you go is mean, and that works. It's a button that you can press, and it works. And pointing out how stupid someone is also works, guaranteed. It's an easy way to generate laughter. But after you're doing it for a while, you go, all right, well, this is maybe it's cheap. It's certainly not. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just there's other ways to go, which has been fun, because in the last couple of years I've started to dig a little deeper.
Well, at a certain point you want to flesh out your characters, mm-hmm. so that people have affection for them, even the stupid ones.
Well, the magic sauce of, I think, all great comedies is that the characters have affection for one another. I mean, one of the things we talked about on Roseanne, speaking of something topical, now it's suddenly topical again, was when I was on the show in 90, 91, something like that, 92, John Goodman's love of her, Dan Connor's love of his wife, translated to the audience. The mm-hmm. audience could feel it. He'd take a bullet for her, mm-hmm. right? And same thing with Archie Bunker. Hmm. Edith loved him unconditionally.
Yeah,
and you excused so much of his toxicity because she loved him unconditionally. So did his daughter, yeah. right? And so affection was very much. Look at Rhea Perlman's love for Sam Malone. She worshipped him, right? And you know he was a player, right? He's kind of not the brightest bulb, but you know, and he was a ladies' man and whatnot. Maybe not altogether, worthy of worship. But she worshipped him, and the guys around the bar, you know, he was the center of the bar, and that affection translates to you while you're watching. I think it did to me, you know, and even in most mean-spirited shows. You're watching an ensemble that clings to one another. Hmm. And that's something we want, I think, as human beings.
And what's more, on top of many other achievements, you have validated nerds.
Yes.
That wasn't the goal.
What was the goal?
I've said this over and over again. Nobody wants to believe me. You know what really attracted me to Big Bang when we started, you know, fleshing it out, and believe me, it went through a lot of iterations that were just wrong. But when we finally got the show that we saw was working, I liked the idea that this was a show about characters who, despite their brilliance, struggled to connect with other human beings. Mm. They weren't nerds or geeks, although those words are easily applicable now looking at it. They were lonely. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have a relationship with a woman, didn't know how. How is that not universal for most men?
I was gonna say, who couldn't relate to that?
Who couldn't relate to that? Their mental capacity did not solve the problem for mm-hmm. them. Mm. Because the problem wasn't solvable through intellect, you know, and that's what was appealing to me. I thought that was something everybody could relate to. Certainly, something I understood.
The range of shows that you've done. How many do you have on the air right now?
There's three on CBS, and we have something coming up on Netflix for the fall.
Why shouldn't you? Why shouldn't you? My I think my letter carrier has a show on Netflix coming up this fall.
Lucky guy.
Very. How do you stay involved on a hands-on basis with so many things going on? Obviously, you have acquired a skill for time management.
Mm-hmm. It was a great story that goes to time management. When the Big Bang Theory got started, was picked up for the fall season 11 years ago, something like that, because we're coming into our 12th season. So I was terrified because Two and a Half Men was happening and it was successful. And this second show was coming up, and I'd never had the situation where I had two shows at work. And so I called out, I cold-called Norman Lear. I just called his office and said, and told him who I was and what I was doing. And I said, would Mr. Lear be willing to talk to me? Because I think he had seven. I don't know, something crazy back in the day. And he was very gracious, and he gave me a time to come over and sit with him. And I've since spoken with him about this. He has an impeccable memory, but he doesn't remember it, but I do. I asked him, how did you, you know, distribute your time? How did you effectively, how could you, because one was too much. How was I possibly going to go and write and produce two, you know, or co-write? You don't do any of this stuff alone. And he said, you're not going to like the answer. And the answer for him was, you go where the fire is burning the brightest and you try and put it out. It was damage control.
That's a solid answer, though.
Go where the fire is burning the brightest and try and put it out. So, you know, and that's how he, you know, ran from show to show, trying to be, to contribute.
Yeah.
And not get in the way, because you can also slow things down.
Yeah.
You can also be a problem. If you parachute in at the last minute and go, oh, this isn't working, not only does it destroy any kind of process, but it's dispiriting. You know. And I've been in situations where people parachute in at the last minute and say, oh, this isn't working. It's like, well, wait a minute, we've been working on this day and night for a couple of weeks, where were you? And so that's not a good way to work. And also over time, what I've discovered is, you know, you discover great writers and you cling to them. You cling to them because they see things differently than you, and that's a gift. That's a gift. One of the great things about The Big Bang Theory is going into its 12th season, we've had basically, you know, three showrunners. You know, myself and Steve Malero and now Steve Holland. And the perspective changes as that happens. And the perspective changing is a good thing. You know, the tone of the show changes somewhat. And that's a good thing. It almost reinvents the show.
Keeps it fresh.
It keeps it from being redundant.
Keeps it fresh for all you guys.
It keeps it fresh for all of us. And frankly, you know, I think if any one person did it that long, it has to get redundant. I think I would have ran it into the ground if I hadn't stepped away.
What do you enjoy most right now, freedom-wise, with the success that you've had? Like, what do you get to do now that you maybe didn't get to do before? Is it just everything you want?
I still enjoy being in a room with writers. Really do.
It's
fun. It can be frightening and frustrating. But, you know, after all these years, I've come to understand that frightening and frustrating passes. The panic attack that's crawling up your esophagus and thinking, oh God, we're doomed, we can't come up with one more story, or we don't know what the second act is, or the scene doesn't work and I don't know how to fix it, that panic subsides and something happens. Somebody says something that inspires someone else to say something else and disagree with what was first said, but you know, cauldron comes something that works, and you know, you just know it. This works, and then the writing flows, and it's fun, and you're laughing, and you're sitting in a room with other adults laughing. That's not a bad deal.
No, that's a great deal.
You know, and when you take it out in front of an audience, and the audience spontaneously erupts with real laughter, not mercy laughs. We know the difference. It's so genuinely a fulfilling experience.
What's mercy laughter?
It's laughter that an audience will give you, and you can hear it, and you don't want to put it on television. Hmm. You either fix that line or cut it, but you don't. You can't at this point be, misled by that, because they think they're supposed to laugh because they're at a taping of a sitcom. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But if it's not truly funny, don't put it on television, because it ain't going to be funny in your living room.
Yeah.
It's just not. And the truth of a sitcom with an audience, a live audience, is if you hear the audience laughing and you're not, there's a cognitive dissonance there. It's a disconnect. What's happening? Mm. That laughter is abhorrent. It's obnoxious, because you ain't laughing. In the best of all worlds, you don't hear it because you're laughing along with it, right?
Yes, 100%.
You shouldn't hear the laughter on a sitcom because you're laughing. If you're hearing it and you're not laughing, you're not even chuckling, you're bemused, then you failed, and the show is failing.
Yeah.
You've gotten to work with so many interesting guest stars. But before we started recording, you mentioned Carl Reiner, mm-hmm. but you've gotten to have so many, between all of these shows that you've gotten, there are plenty. You've gotten to work with all kinds of what I would consider heroes. Which ones were you just like, yes, I need to get this guy, or I really want to see so-and-so?
Right off the bat, I got to plug this Netflix show that's coming up this fall called The Kominsky Method, where I got to work with Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin, mm-hmm. which was like, are you kidding me? I mean, I've been watching both these men for 50 years.
Yeah.
Maybe more. And to get a chance to work with them was a thrill. And because of them, we're they're magnets for people that I, Ann Margaret did a couple of episodes, and it drew Jay Leno on the show, and Patti LaBelle and Elliot Gould, and I was in this just incredible, rich environment where I'm getting to work with people that I've admired for a long time. On the Big Bang Theory, well, we got to work with Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking,
He wrote a lovely piece about Stephen Hawking, too.
Yeah. That was, how can you imagine that happening?
Yeah.
That not only did he, participate in the show, but he became one of our biggest supporters. And whenever we asked him to do anything, he'd record a voiceover, something like a phone call situation or whatever, he never said no. Hmm. He never said no. And it's just something you never forget. And we've been really fortunate. That show has drawn Nobel Prize laureates, and it's astonishing what's happened with the Big Bang Theory.
It's going strong, too. It's going strong. It just gets more and more popular. I don't know how.
And then there's that spinoff.
That little something.
Well, it's not true. It's not a spinoff, because no character in the Big Bang Theory has been taken off to be on it. That would be the accurate word for spinoff. You take a character out of a show and start a new show.
Okay. I accept your correction.
It's a prequel.
Prequel. Okay.
A prequel.
Yes.
A prequel.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely word.
It is.
Yeah.
Prequel. It is.
Yeah, there's a cut in it.
And it works.
That's been another great learning experience, too, because I've spent 30 years working with shows, doing stuff in front of a live audience. I've never been involved with something that's shot as a film.
Hmm.
That has its own rhythm, that the rhythm isn't determined by audience laughter. It's the rhythm of the piece. It's more intimate. The camera gets closer. Mm-hmm. There's score. There's no score in a four-camera sitcom. Yeah. There's no music bed. There's not much going on camera and lighting-wise. It's pretty simple. It's that way for speed. It's done that way to do things quickly. You can't put a show in front of an audience and expect them to sit there for 10 hours or whatever it would take to shoot a dinner scene in film style.
So are you enjoying this new experience?
It's taken a while because slower. It's so much slower.
Right.
You know, what you would normally shoot in 30 minutes in front of an audience can take 5 hours, film style. But then when you put it together in editing, you know, you have so much more nuance than you could have ever had. You know, a raised eyebrow is effective, you know, in single camera because the camera can be closer. You know, the proscenium is what you're basically showing the audience in a four-camera show, like almost from the perspective of a theater viewer.
Yeah.
Actually,
it's like a play.
Yes, it's like a play, but still the camera is showing you where to look.
Yeah.
Right? In a play, you're just looking at the stage.
Right.
And you and the magic of theater is directing your eyes to where they want your eyes to go, because otherwise you could be looking the wrong way and miss the entrance of the character stage left. And so it's there's all kinds of magic tricks in theater to control the audience's line of sight. And the camera does that in television.
Well, I hope you continue to be rewarded for this experiment on your part, because the audience is responding to it.
I'm delighted. I'm, you know, it was once we started working on that, we quickly realized, well, if we don't cast this young man correctly, we're going to fail immediately.
Mm.
And you know, Ian Armitage was just a gift from God. He's an extraordinarily talented little boy. He's just amazing and crazy smart, you know. And then we, you know, the rest of the cast came around him in the most magical way. You know, Zoe Perry, Laurie Metcalf's daughter, who I've known since she's 5 years old.
Hmm.
She used to run around the set on Roseanne in the early 90s playing with the other kids on the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she worked in the costume department on Big Bang when she was a teenager, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, 20 years old, 19, 20 years old, she was working with the costumers as a production assistant of some kind. And now she's one of the stars of Young Sheldon.
Wow.
And she didn't get the part because she's Laurie's daughter. She won the part.
Mm.
She came in and read for it and went, holy mackerel. Are you kidding me? Can we possibly be this lucky? She's a skilled actress with great instincts. And there's that genetic component that's undeniably Laurie. You know? And who plays Sheldon's mother on the Big Bang Theory. So just a lot of fortuitous things happened there.
Well, as I think Woody Allen said, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
That's a good line. I was just reading about him this morning, about if he wanted to be remembered through his films, or did he want his... I'm going to ruin it. He wanted to be remembered by not dying. It was something like that. Right?
I know what you're talking about.
Memory of your work. I want to live in my apartment. It was something like that.
Astonishingly. Line. Yes.
Yes. I don't want to die. but yeah, I've been very fortunate. I got to stay in the sandbox long enough to learn from my mistakes, and I keep making them. But the great thing about television is there is a learning curve if you're lucky enough to stay on the air.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it better by trial and error. Really, if you look at the Big Bang Theory, where it started and where it is now, these characters evolved.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know,
as in any good show.
But we as writers evolved, and we got better at it, because in the beginning we were just flailing around in the dark trying to figure out what the show was.
It's alive. It's a living, breathing thing.
Yeah, it's a living, breathing thing. And I've been the formula approach, you know, to try and come up with a formula seems stultifying to me. It's just that seemed to be a recipe for death, you know. Why would you want to put a formula on it? You want to stay true to your characters, but you also want your characters to grow. So,
well, you do. That's because you're a good writer and producer.
Why, thank you.
There are some people, as you well know, who like formulas, who think that that's the way to do it, the way to be productive, because you don't have to rethink it every time.
Uh-huh.
You follow the formula.
Sure, but the paradox of television, for me, has always been. You want Archie Bunker to stay Archie Bunker because you're watching All in the Family because you love Archie Bunker, despite right. his flaws, despite his sometimes abhorrent views.
Mm-hmm.
You like the character. But if the character never changes, if there's no incremental growth in the character, then you get bored.
And there always was
that incremental thing that happened, and that's the magic trick, that balancing act of the characters can't change, but they can't stay the same.
Yeah.
That's the paradox.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well, Norman Lear understood that.
He certainly did. He certainly did, and he kind of made television great as a result.
Chuck, we know that you have to go off and probably create another show this afternoon.
12 more.
Boy, I hope not. Thank you.
Chuck, it's so kind of you to give us your time today. We really appreciate it. And it's fun talking to you.
Thank you. Hey, you guys are great.
Oh,
this was fun.
You. Thank you for everything you've created.
Thank you.
I'm definitely the kind of person where TV is my happy place. And mm-hmm. it relaxes me and it makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, that's what I look to. So it's a lovely thing to have shows that bring me joy and are easy for me to just fall into and have a good time. So
thank you for that.
You're doing good things.
Thanks. Say hi to your mom.
Oh, I will. She's going to plot. So be great.
Okay. So, plots. Now we know who we are.
Well, please.
It was never a secret.
Never a secret.
This is Mishpucha. It's the whole thing. We're here.
I love that word.
So say your Netflix show again.
The Kaminsky Method.
The Kaminsky Method.
November. When does it debut?
Middle of November.
Mm-hmm.
I think before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
15th?
This is why we have publicists and assistants. This is that they hold up all the dates and we go, thank you.
This gentleman here, he's my frontal lobe.
Well.
The cerebellum.
Friday the 16th.
Thank you, Nico.
Okay. All right. Is there a place people follow you to keep up with your comings and goings?
No.
Tough. Tough luck on them.
I don't understand the need to take pictures of what I'm eating and share them. It's enough to communicate through television. That's enough.
Yeah. And you got those vanity cards, too.
Sure. If I want to get myself in trouble, I can always write a vanity card. Yeah.
And Jesse, where do they find us?
You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com to read about books and film and all kinds of good stuff.
All of that. And once again, we thank you, Chuck, and we thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.